Coming up on Golf Today, Tiger and TGL. The big cat makes his debut tomorrow in South Florida. As the new league gears up for night number two, will the early buzz continue? And big names in Dubai with some big questions. Can Rory dominate in 2025? And what to make of Jon Rahm? Can the former world number one become a force in the game once again?
Golf Today.
What a nice moment for Nick Taylor, who had to have his heart broken last year. He was not a part of Mike Weir's President's Cup team at Royal Montreal, where Weir's the captain. Yet it was a Maple Leaf Fest for that week. And remember, we had Mike Weir on the show, and he talked about how heartbroken he was having to make that phone call. He said, "These guys are my brothers," talking about Taylor in Haven. What a nice moment for him after last year's disappointment.
It is. It's a nice redemption, but you can also say that Mike Weir's decision at the time was thoroughly justified. And you just have to look at what is the essential inconsistency of Nick Taylor here. And maybe this is just the prototype of the modern tour pro, where you have to be wholly opportunistic on the weeks where you're playing well, because there are a lot of weeks when you don't play well. And, you know, Nick won the Phoenix Open last year. He tied 12th a couple of weeks later at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. The rest of the year, Nick didn't finish better than 25th, a tie for 25th. And there's an interesting stat. If you look at Nick Taylor over the last 4 years, this really speaks to the inconsistency. Four wins, just eight top tens outside of those four wins, 47 missed cuts in that four-year period. But Nick Taylor is now inside the top 30 in the official world golf ranking. He's guaranteed a job on the PGA Tour for the next couple of years. He is an excellent golfer. He's an excellent PGA Tour player, but there is a level of inconsistency there where he grabs it by the throat when the opportunity presents itself. But he's not a regular contender week in, week out by any.
But who is?
I think a lot of guys who are in the top 10 in the world are there week
in, week out. I think you've hit on something in the modern game, whether we're talking about Hideki Matsuyama if the putter cooperates, if we're talking about Scottie Scheffler if the putter cooperates, Rory from time to time, Justin Thomas. You know, Nick Taylor was 109th in strokes gained putting last year. It does seem like in this modern game where it seems like, you know, almost everybody can hit the ball pretty well. The equipment's pretty, you know, homogenized across the board. It's the short game and the putter. Who's getting up and down that week? Who's making the knee knockers? You know, who's making the 60 for 65 inside 10 feet stat, as it were?
Yeah, and even starting that playoff yesterday, if you were a betting man, you were probably going to go for Nico Echevarria. I mean, he's in his last six starts, he's had four top six finishes, three of them in the top two. He won at the Zozo back in the fall in Japan as well. And he is fast emerging as one of the real guys to keep an eye on the PGA Tour. The weakness, or it's not really a weakness, I suppose the untested part of Nico Echevarria is he hasn't played signature events.
Right.
He hasn't won against the absolute best fields on the PGA Tour. He's won in the Puerto Rico Open, and he's won the Zozo, which was, again, a limited field event, not the strongest field that we saw last fall by any measure. So that's, I suppose, the next thing for Nico to step up and see how he performs in those signature events against the absolute best that the PGA Tour has to offer. That's a different level. He's winning at the PGA Tour level, but he is not yet winning against the best the PGA Tour has to offer week in, week out.
And I think you're right. You use the word opportunistic. I mean, that's what the game is about these days. We're seeing a haves and have-nots, the importance of getting into the signature events, A, and then performing when you get into them, B. Not to mention that the big, I don't want to say cloud, but one of the storylines over this season is the fact that these guys have to hustle. 125 is gone. It's 100 PGA Tour cards. We're going to have a round table in just a little bit, talk to Ryan Lavener and Paige McKenzie. I want to ask Paige about just the pressure difference on players, knowing that it's not 125 anymore. Maybe you had a little more wiggle room back in the day. What will the players be feeling, not so much in January, but late in the summer when you're at 108, 109 on the FedEx Cup standings and what you have to try to do this season? You know, you better be opportunistic because the opportunities aren't as plentiful as they were in past seasons.
And I guess Nick Taylor is a great example that you could have a lot of poor weeks out there, but as long as you have one good week, you are keeping that job. Well, here's a look at the Comcast Business Tour Top 10. Nick Taylor, got 500 FedEx Cup points. He's now number second in the standings, as you'd expect, 2 weeks into the season. Since 2009, every player who's finished in the Business Tour top 10 has made it all the way to the Tour Championship at Eastlake.
Well, somebody knows what it's like to win the Tour Championship. Tiger Woods. Last time we saw the 15-time major champ tee it up was last month at the PNC Championship alongside his son Charlie. The duo played some great golf, coming up just short to the duo of Bernhard and Jason Langer. Well, guess what? Tiger's going to tee it up tomorrow night at the SoFi Center in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida for week two of his new indoor golf venture, TGL. Reminder, teams play 15 holes each match. They're divided into two sessions, 9 holes of triples. That's the 3-on-3 alternate shot. Then 6 holes of singles to follow.
Here's a look at Tiger's team this week. As you know, 3 of the 4 team members actually compete on any given week. The Jupiter Links team is putting out Tiger, Kevin Kisner, and Max Homa, who's actually from LA, but he's not playing for LA. One guy is though, Colin Morikawa, another LA native. He's on the team alongside Justin Rose, making his way from the Middle East to play, and Sahith Theegala. So pretty good lineup for tomorrow night. What are you expecting? Finally, we get to see Tiger when he's not being upstaged by Charlie.
Yeah, I think Tiger's going to lean into this and enjoy it. He's a co-founder of TGL. He's also a big video games guy. At least he was back in the day when he first turned professional, liked to play Mortal Kombat, sometimes even, you know, gearing up for a PGA Tour event. And I think this kind of speaks to the little kid in Tiger. Obviously, he wants this venture to be successful, but it's competition. He's going to bring his best, you know that. But I just think the vehicle in which this golf is being served is something that will kind of play to the little kid inside Tiger as well.
But he's certainly invested in it in every sense.
Yes.
I guess. And we've only seen Tiger make 11 starts in the last 4 years. This might be, unless the health improves, this might be where we see Tiger most frequently this year. But it's an interesting dichotomy here, because it's a chance for the swing nerds to assess the mechanics of Tiger's swing, because you are going to see him play a wide range of shots out there. But it's not a means of testing his competitive stamina, because he ain't walking anywhere except around a little self-contained stadium here. So it's not really going to be much of a barometer in terms of Tiger's ability to sustain a level of play over 72 holes in a PGA Tour event. It's just going to be nice to see him in what is not entirely a relaxed environment, because it still matters something to these guys, as we saw last week. But it's going to be nice to see him actually swing a golf club in what is a pretty fun environment.
This is, you know, Shell's Wonderful World of Golf in 2025, you know, for a new generation. There's going to be laughs, there'll be some, you know, some digs and some barbs between the teams and the players. But this is probably the type of, you know, entity we're going to see more and more of Tiger Woods in. And we're always going to wonder what he has in advance of the Masters. But more and more it's about, you know, are we going to see Tiger at the Hero? Are we going to see Tiger at the PNC? Are we going to see Tiger at something like TGL? I mean, this might be the new world and the new way we have to view Tiger Woods, as opposed to, you know, how's his golf swing looking in advance of trying to win a 16th major championship.
And having Max Homa on site is interesting as well, because no one kind of does the trash talking better in golf, certainly on the PGA Tour, than Max Homa does. But there will also be, I suppose, a sobering aspect of it too. When you have the Los Angeles team there, given the tough situation that's going on out there, you can expect some kind of acknowledgement of that situation is probably going to be made during the course of the broadcast as well. But ultimately, they are trying to put on an entertainment product here, and they have some of the more entertaining guys in the game. I want to see Sahith Theegala in this kind of setting as well.
Yeah, another LA native. I'll be watching tomorrow. Fun to see what Tiger brings to the table. Sometimes those players get mic'd up and, you know, they try a little too hard, but hopefully the humor comes out and they can have a little fun and entertainment tomorrow in South Florida.
Let's hope for that.
We're back on Golf Today. Mornings just got a little bit better. Be sure to tune in Mondays for this lineup on Golf Channel 5 Clubs Podcast with Gary Williams, Fairways of Life with Matt Adams. You got the likes of Andy Roddick and Webb Simpson on the show. And then Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. They made their debut this morning, and the guys looked fantastic.
Well, it's time now for Golf Today Roundtable, and we're going to elevate things this week. We have the aforementioned Ryan Lavner, of course, Golf Channel senior writer. Paige McKenzie Also joining us, which gives us one LPGA Tour veteran and three guys who are veterans of nothing more than Golden Tee machines and speedy bars. Paige, I want to start with you. The LPGA Tour is about to embark on its 75th season. It's doing so without a commissioner, Molly Marcuse-Mann having stepped down last week. There are a couple of key holes in the schedule in terms of sponsorships. You've been around this tour for a long time. You covered as much as anyone. What's your level of concern heading into such a big season with those couple of empty spots?
I think heading into any season with an absent leader, effectively the absent CEO of the company, that is concerning. Now, Liz Moore is taking over as interim commissioner. She's bright. She was the legal counsel for LPGA for many years. I served on the board. She was with the organization some 10 years ago when I was on the board. I've been impressed by her, so I think she's a very competent person to take the reins in this interim portion. But I know the expected date of finding a new commissioner. We're not expecting to hear anything from the LPGA as it relates to new leadership until May. So we're talking well into the season. Then there will be a transition period, a learning curve potentially for the new commissioner coming in. So absolutely, I'm concerned. I'm concerned because there's phone calls that start when you're talking about contract renewals, when you're talking about corporate deals that need to happen in these first 5 months. And if there is uncertainty in leadership, then there is a possibility that there's reluctance for bringing new partners on board, or at least reassuring your old partners in the soundness of the tour right now. So I absolutely have concern. I'm disappointed in how this all went down, that the transition period between Mike Wan and Molly Marcuse-Mann was not as smooth as it should have been. I feel like there's been questionable decisions as it relates to the priorities of the last kind of administration of the LPGA Tour. So I'm anxious coming into this 75th season to see how it's all going to unfold. I mean, the product is as good as it's ever been, and yet I feel like there's a lack of leadership at the top of the LPGA Tour and has been for a while.
Lav, we'll get to you in a second, but I want to follow up with Paige, because during this time of flux in leadership on the LPGA Tour, how incumbent is it then on the players to do some reassuring of said sponsors and fans?
Absolutely. I mean, the players have always been pretty active in the sponsorship role, or the meeting the needs of the sponsors, right? The sponsors get involved in sports marketing and in women's golf in particular to have that close relationship with the sport. Unlike buying a box at an NBA arena, the sponsors here get to play inside the ropes on a Wednesday pro-am. So the players have always been integral in that relationship. So I anticipate that the players are going to continue to step up the way that they have in being the great product that they are. I have more top-level concern than how the players will respond in this moment.
Ryan, we just had a conversation about these comments from Eugenio Chicara, now no longer with LIV Golf, saying that it was just about the money. He was promised world ranking points that were never delivered. It seems to be a bit of a theme emerging here since Carlos Ortiz said last year he was also promised ranking points. Those were not within LIV's gift to offer. Do you think these guys are starting to realize that the promise that they were sold is turning into a bit of a bill of goods, and at a certain point, if they don't have status, then they're just kind of surplus to requirements?
I think for some of them, certainly, Eamon, they could be coming to that realization. Like, you think back to early 2022, and there was such the fear of the unknown, and if you're an LIV official, you had to entice players to get this thing off the ground. And so they promised official world golf ranking points. They promised access to the majors was not going to be cut off. They promised that the PGA Tour could not ban them. And then despite what Greg Norman was telling these players, all of those things obviously happened. I think as it relates to the discussion that you guys just had in the previous segment about Eugenio Chicara, one thing I would really take exception with was when he said, quote, "I'm not a guy who wants more money." Eugenio said that he wants to play for legacy. He wants to play for tradition. He wants to play to alter the trajectory of his career. And he's obviously certainly free to change his mind after experiencing LIV for 3 years. But let's be very clear about this. Eugenio Chicara and his team wanted the money 3 years ago. That's why they jumped while it was still very much a risk of what could potentially happen to who was then the second-ranked player in the amateur ranks. He was obviously extremely well compensated for that decision. The Spanish outlets are reporting he earned anywhere from $30 million. And so now he has I think, more financial freedom than a lot of young players who are sort of in his position now having to go to Asia. So I think that's important context to remember that yes, they were maybe sold a bill of goods and it hasn't quite panned out how they thought, but they were also extremely well compensated for the decision that they were going to be making.
Well, the Fireball is a team that's undergoing some flux. I'm more curious, Paige, about the teams that'll be teeing it up tomorrow in TGL. Tiger Woods making his debut. I'm curious, as an LPGA veteran, how much are you watching this simulator golf? What has been your kind of early impression of the new league?
Oh, I watched it. I mean, I watched, what was it, last week or the week prior? Had a chance to kind of check it out. I thought it was interesting. I was curious, not only as a golfer, but also being in television, how are they going to produce this? How is it going to work with a host reporter? If they're going to have an analyst, how that was all going to play out. The shot clock was interesting, kept everything moving. Felt like it was a little more difficult to build suspense because it was fast-paced. But the quality of golf was good. We saw some good shots, which I liked. Obviously, as a golfer, that's why you tune in. Today, or this week, I'm excited to see Tiger Woods tee it up. I'm going to just reserve 100% judgment until I have a better grasp. The one complaint I would have is it's difficult to keep it on the background and know exactly what's going on. And that is the one thing. You got to be fully engaged in it. So it's very different than traditional golf. I need to figure out if I like that. If I can disconnect and just keep it on the background, like that, is that going to be a way that you can view this, or do you actually need to sit down and 100% focus? But if that's my biggest critique so far, then I think we're doing okay, and I like the variety that we're seeing in the game of golf and different ways to consume it.
I guess we're all programmed to go get that drink while somebody's walking to their golf ball. We don't have that luxury with TGL right now.
Right.
Paige, before we have a quick break, I just want to circle back on the commissioner question. What do you think is the biggest issue that will be on the desk of the next commissioner on day one, regardless of how long it takes to get there or who it is? What, in your mind, is the big thing they're going to have to tackle right away?
Given the reporting that came out in December about the spending deficit and that there was a $2 million loss in 2024, I want to have an idea, or at least the commissioner needs to figure out how big of an issue is that? Is this an immediate crisis they need to rectify? Is this a Titanic heading in the wrong direction? Or is this something that can be absorbed and we're expecting different this year? I think that's the one thing, Eamon, when you asked Molly about that $2 million, I was expecting or hoping to hear, well, yeah, but that spending is going to pay off in 2025. We have committed to new sponsorships because we added staffing. They added, according to Beth Ann Nichols' reporting, 28% more staff. I just looked at their tax records. Between 2022 and 23, they added 38% in compensation for employees. I'm concerned that there might be a necessity to spend or to rein in the spending immediately. And what does that mean? In addition to trying to find more corporate deals and get the sponsorship dollars they need to make up for it. But again, I'm not on the inside. I think that's something that I hope to hear from our next commissioner is, how serious is it? How concerned should we all be in the financial health of the LPGA Tour?
Paige, Jordan Spieth has been out since last summer, of course, had wrist surgery. He's announced he's coming back in a couple of weeks at Pebble Beach, where he's had a tremendous amount of success over the years. What is a reasonable expectation for that week? And for that year, I mean, you've played coming out of injuries. You know how difficult it is to actually find some kind of rhythm. Is it too easy to expect too much too soon?
Yeah, absolutely. It's too easy to expect too much. I mean, there is competitive rust typically when coming off of a long layoff. As Jordan Spieth has mentioned, it's the longest ever that he's gone without competing. For Jordan Spieth, I don't have enormous expectations. My expectations lie with getting 72 holes in under his belt without having any pain. He talked about taking 12 full weeks off without playing golf and then another month before completing a round. So he's given it a ton of time, and I think handling it the way that you would hope an athlete would to get the maximum benefit of having that surgery. But I'm actually just kind of curious how the offseason went. I think as somebody that's competed for a very long time, and you talked about it, some of the best that we saw of Jordan Spieth was over 10 years ago. Hard to believe he's been on tour that long. How was that off time? I think a lot of players at that point in the career start to look at their lives and say, you know what? being home every night, sleeping in my own bed every night, being with my family every day. Like, this is a pretty good life. So my curiosity is there a complacency that comes with it, or is there a renewed love of the game because he's healthy now? I think there's the possibility it could go one of two ways.
Of course, he also saw some snow on the ground in Dallas last week. That probably didn't lend itself to the preparations well either.
Yeah, no doubt, Lav. I'm curious about his importance to the PGA Tour 10 years after the spring and summer of Spieth. You know, in this fractured game, is he still as important to the PGA Tour as ever before as he makes this comeback?
Oh, I think Jordan Spieth's reemergence this year potentially as an elite player once again would be absolutely massive for the PGA Tour. You look at the Player Impact Program rankings that were just released. Jordan Spieth was still number five on the PIP list, despite not really being competitive for much of the 2024 season. And so you look at all that's been lost on the PGA Tour over the past couple of years. Yes, LIV Golf took a lot of the villains, but the PGA Tour right now, to me, seems to be lacking some heroes as well. You know, Scottie Scheffler is a beloved figure, but he's mostly awed and he's admired for the way that he plays the game. Rory has become somewhat of a polarizing figure to fans. Where are the players who are universally liked and beloved and who have sort of the thrill factor that Jordan Spieth does? I think he's sort of singular in that aspect, that he remains one of the game's preeminent, most entertaining players. We just want to see him sort of entertain more often, be in contention more often, get back to sort of the major winning form and contention that we're accustomed to seeing to Jordan Spieth over the past decade or so.
Presumably, he's also got an eye on Bethpage in September for the Ryder Cup. Page, captain Keegan Bradley's made a pretty good start to the year. He was sixth in Sony. He was top 15 last week at the Century. It's not all that far-fetched. He could be in the mix for a Ryder Cup spot. He says he won't pick himself. It's not inconceivable that he could actually qualify. In your mind, is that realistically doable to be both player and captain given the scale of the job?
During the week of, I think there's got to be a huge support staff around him if that were to be the case. What I find most fascinating about Keegan, and I was there at the BMW in Colorado this fall where he won, it was amazing to see the amount of support around Keegan on the golf course, USA Chance, that really truly felt like it buoyed him to the finish line. That he rose to the occasion that the fans were hoping and expecting of him. And you wonder if that sustains, if that won't continue to inspire him to play his best golf. But as it relates to the week of, I think that would be incredibly difficult to be both. Not impossible, but very, very difficult.
Lav, I'm curious your thought on the same question, because to hear the Europeans tell it, they want Keegan to be a playing captain. I mean, Paul McGinley came on this show and was cackling at the thought. As someone who will be asking Keegan and a lot of players questions that week, is it just too much going on between the press conferences and the lineups in this modern incarnation of the Ryder Cup to do both?
I mean, I think it'd be a monumental achievement if Keegan Bradley could even put himself in the mix in order to be selected either as a wild card pick for the Ryder Cup or qualify automatically if he finishes among the top six. I mean, we have decades of data that shows that the U.S. Ryder Cup captain, once he gets picked, his game sort of falls off the cliff. And I don't expect that to happen with Keegan Bradley. He's still, as you mentioned, a top 15 player in the world who's off to a good start in 2025. But I think it could potentially grate on him as the season wears on and as he continues to climb up the point standings for the U.S. team. I believe he was 18th heading into the Sony. Obviously would make a little bit of a climb with his top 10 finish at Wailea. Every time that Keegan Bradley gets into contention for the rest of the year, he's going to be asked how that could potentially impact the U.S. Ryder Cup team, how it impacts his thinking. That sort of burden on you for the next 8 or 9 months has got to be, I mean, it's got to be really difficult to deal with. So I think, first of all, it would be a monumental achievement just to get in that mix. And then when it comes down to it, week of, yeah, he would completely have to delegate to his assistants and be strictly a player, similar to what we saw at the President's Cup, where, yes, he was an assistant captain. He was relieved of those duties, just focus on being a player. Now, you do have 8 or 9 months to prepare your assistants, and they certainly have to have that contingency plan in place.
One of the big storylines in 2025. Lav, Page, we don't want to spend our Monday with anyone else. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Two huge names are teeing it up in the desert this week, just not on the PGA Tour in the California desert. Rory McIlroy will expect a big week as he defends his title and aims for a fifth win in Dubai. John Rahm needs a big year to remind people that he's not the 31st ranked golfer in the world, which is what the facts say he is. And the DP World Tour just wrapped the Team Cup in the Middle East this weekend. You can bet Keegan Bradley was paying attention to see what opposing captain Luke Donald was trying out ahead of the Ryder Cup. Golf Today rolls on right now.
Golf Today.
Hour two of Golf Today starting now. He's Damon Hack. I'm Eamon Lynch. Damon, a lot of attention will be on the PGA Tour in the California desert this weekend. A lot of eyeballs. Eight time zones to the east.
Yeah, well said. I often say while sitting in this chair, I love this time of year. And I do love this time of year. Golf in the California desert, as you say, and golf in the Middle East as well. Great way to start there. I've been in Dubai once, but never with golf clubs. Have you?
I have not. It's high on the list of places to get to in life. But this is also one of the events that does tend to draw a pretty strong field start in the year. The European Tour basically started 2 weeks after the last one ended last fall. But this is really traditionally the week where the big guns start to show up. Even Victor Hovland with his wounded pinky is out there, and the new swing coach in tow as well.
Yeah, the Burj Khalifa, very, very tall. Let's take a look at what's happening this week as the first Rolex Series event of the year gets underway. The Hero Dubai Desert Classic. I mean, look at those buildings. A lot of them have grown over the last, 20, 30 years. It's making its 36th appearance on the DP World Tour's International Swing. This event started way back in 1989. It's been held every year since, with the exception of 1991 when it was canceled due to the Gulf War.
And Rory McIlroy has won four times here, including each of the last 2 years. Last year, he entered the final round two shots behind Cameron Young, but by the final hole, he just needed two putts from short range to capture that fourth title and his 17th win on the DP World Tour. And this is what Rory McIlroy did in 2024. A lot of starts for him last year. 27 starts, 23 of them in the top 25, 14 top 10s, 4 runner-up finishes, and of course, 4 victories. And by anyone else's standards, that's a career there. By Rory McIlroy's standards, not quite, because Rory's now at the point of his career where he's judged by a different metric. And yes, the wins on any tour are great, but it's the majors that have become this kind of, they were the defining aspect of the early part of his career. Now there's something of a millstone until the next one comes. And of course, last year brought just one contention in a major, and it was a pretty painful loss.
That millstone is getting heavier and heavier. And I was digging kind of into the stories of the last decade. I used to just think, you know, bad luck, you know, somebody would pip him at the post. But over the last couple of years, I've started to wonder if the scar tissue has built up to the point where it's real and he feels it. I started to question it at the Los Angeles Country Club at the U.S. Open, where Wyndham Clark beat him. He was a little bit shaky down the stretch. At Pinehurst number two, that's when I thought, this is an issue. I think he's feeling the absence of that fifth major championship. I was so stunned at the misses down the stretch with the short putts. I mean, the 18th, the 72nd hole, that was a harder putt than the couple of holes previously. But I just feel like this has become the talking point. You know, it used to be, well, he's going to be right next to Seve and Sir Nick Faldo and perhaps, you know, surpass them as the greatest European golfer of all time. And now I feel like, man, this has gotten hard, and he's feeling the absence. And he talks about going into the Masters overprepared, underprepared. I'm going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it. I mean, he's going about these chases in different ways.
Yeah, there's definitely the burden that's there, and certainly the scar tissue as well, which is testament to the resilience that he shows, because there have now been 3 consecutive years where Rory McIlroy has taken a significant gut punch in majors that would have broken many a lesser golfer. You go all the way back to St. Andrews when he was tied for the lead with Victor Hovland heading into that final round. And they had a gap between them. Couldn't buy a putt all day long out there. That was a painful one. Then, of course, the LACC that you mentioned that lost to Wyndham Clark. and then add Pinehurst on top of that. And to me, it's testament to the character that he said he would go through that another 100 times
more
just
Sundays,
for that one
yes,
feeling
yes.
of coming in. Hopefully, he's not going to have to go through those so much anymore. But that's the point of putting yourself in that position. In that game, at that level, these guys put themselves in position to have their heart torn out and stomped
yeah.
on
yeah.
for those four big tournaments a year, just for the feeling of joy of it going their way once.
Yeah.
And I don't see him changing the kind of resilience or attitude or determination to get there. But the next one is probably going to taste a lot sweeter than any of the previous four did.
Yeah, no doubt. I wonder if the chase will be a little bit different now that Scottie Scheffler is the undisputed Brahma Bull alpha male, world number one in the game. And if that changes the pressure level that Rory McIlroy is feeling, does it give him a little bit of cover as he tries to go about his business? Or is the storyline so big and so bright and so, you know, part of the conversation in golf that he has no place to hide as he chases major number five?
Yeah, when you're Rory McIlroy, there is no hiding place. And it's not just that he's the world number three just because the math says he's world number three.
Yeah.
He's very clearly world number three. Both Xander Schauffele and Scottie Scheffler both passed him. Scottie is undisputed world number one. Xander is the undisputed number three, or number two. Rory could be said to have competition gathering at his heels for the number three spot. And Rory McIlroy doesn't want to be in a conversation as to whether or not he deserves to be world number three.
Yeah, we'll see what he has in the Middle East. One thing we know, he's not going to be alone this week. There are some LIV golfers in this field as well. You see Dean Burmester, John Catlin, Adrian Meronk, John Rahm, Patrick Reed, Thomas Peters, Tyrrell Hatton, and Laurie Cantor. And John Rahm's the big name. In this time, we talk about players who have occupied the number one spot in the official world golf ranking. Rory McIlroy has, John Rahm has. You know, we got Eugenio Chikara talking about feelings of want and wanting to be on the PGA Tour. And John Rahm, you have someone who's been on the PGA Tour and has been a dominant player on the PGA Tour. Last year, won top 10 in majors, was really kind of an afterthought in 2024. What do you expect out of big John Rahm in 2025? Because I'm not sure that the schedule that he's played is going to lend, for him anyway, to be major championship tough and major championship ready.
Well, he did show some encouraging signs in the fall when he had to show up in Europe right after the birth of his child to kind of meet the obligations to be necessary, considered for the Ryder Cup this year. And he had a bunch of top 10 finishes in some fairly lower level European Tour events. He wasn't playing against the best in the world out there, but he was performing at a pretty decent level. He won twice on LIV last year, but as we know, those don't count for anything. John Rahm's currently 31st in the official world golf ranking, and there are 4 weeks a year where John Rahm gets to measure himself against a field of significant quality, and it wasn't there last year. Obviously, he withdrew from the US Open, but he missed the cut at the PGA Championship, tied 45th, real middle of the pack at the Masters. And then he played decently at the Open. He was top 10, not necessarily in contention at the very end of it, but he was right there in the mix. I think he was wounded by that collapse in Paris at the Olympics, which was just bizarre. We'd never seen something like that out of John Rahm before. He's a guy who needs a big year, because I don't buy the argument that John Rahm going to LIV has made him a lesser player, and that's what accounts for the major championship underperformance 2024. John Rahm didn't get worse because somebody else was signing his paycheck for him. But, and you know, years come and go where you have a great year and suddenly you slump. But I do think Rahm is going to feel a lot of pressure to prove the point that he's still relevant, that there aren't 30 golfers better than him in the official world golf ranking. And this is a big week for John Rahm because a lot of those guys that he wants to prove a point to will be in the field this week.
It may not speak to a loss of skill, but it could speak to a cloudy mind. And it could speak to...
And he also has three young kids. You can testify to what that does to a man's focus.
I can, I tell you, but I could never hit a drive like John Rahm in my biggest dreams. I just remember speaking to him off camera at the Masters We had done our little three-question thing. He was walking to his next, you know, camera interview, and he turned back to me and said, you know, I'm still playing golf. Like, I'm still, like, almost saying, you know, you can cover me. Like, you can still interview me and talk to me. And I thought it was a neat moment because I've enjoyed covering Jon Rahm when he was a PGA Tour player. But, man, I imagine he has some pangs, and he's talked about missing San Diego. Maybe he would have been in the California desert this week. No, he would have been in Dublin, Ohio, in the springtime competing at Jack's event. There are some places where he was becoming, you know, a headliner, you know, loving those places. San Diego, got engaged in San Diego, loved Torrey Pines, won his major, first major at the U.S. Open. So, yeah, I agree with you that the skills have not diminished, but if you have a cloudy mind, you know, when the mind aches, the body cries out, and he's obviously not been his best. I think there are a lot of reasons for it, and maybe it's more outside the ropes than inside the ropes.
And because Jon Rahm waited until December of 23 to make his decision to go to live, he was not under any doubt about the short-term consequences in terms of world ranking points and access to tour events that he enjoyed playing. But I think Jon Rahm is also on record as having said he thought he would be a catalyst, that the shock of him leaving would force everyone to the table, that all of his peers would rush to get him back on the PGA Tour. And his peers seem to have responded with, whatever, you chose to go. Mm. If anything, it hardened resolve against a quick resolution between the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour. So now Rahm is facing the realization that the consequences of his decision are going to last perhaps longer than he thought it was going to be. He certainly isn't going to be playing on the PGA Tour with any kind of regularity anytime in the next year or two, it would seem. So I think there's a frustration level, and you see that video go around a lot on social media of various clips from Jon Rahm playing on the LIV Tour. He's frustrated. He's angry. Of course, John was frustrated and angry when he played the PGA Tour as well. I just think he doesn't strike me as in a happy place competitively because he's not getting to prove the point that he lives to prove against the best players in the world as often as he wants to.
Does seem like a lot's at stake for the former world number one as he tries to get back atop the official world golf ranking. He's a long way away from where he wants to be. As we know, golf, an international game. Time now for Let's Go Touring, presented by Viking Cruises. Lots to watch this week. The Bahamas Golf Classic at Atlantis Paradise Island on the Corn Ferry Tour. That's 2 p.m. Eastern Time, second round coverage. As we've talked about the Hero Dubai Desert Classic, some big names in the Middle East. That starts Thursday. Then California Desert, the American Express, Thursday, 4 p.m., first round. How about the Mitsubishi Electric Championship at Hualalai? If you haven't grown tired of seeing some beautiful shots in Hawaii, how could you? Yes, good to see the 50 and over set Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, first round coverage of PGA Tour Champions.
Well, from one desert, we're going to hop to another. From Dubai, we're headed out to California next to talk to the man responsible for making sure everything goes smoothly, the American Express. That's coming up next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Well, last year it was an amateur who made history at the American Express. Alabama sophomore Nick Dunlap took down some of the best in the world, became the first amateur to win on the PGA Tour since 1991. Just 20 years old, he was the second youngest winner on tour since World War II. And pretty quickly after that, Dunlap decided to turn professional. He returns this week to defend his title as the PGA Tour returns to La Quinta after a couple of weeks in the Hawaiian Islands. Coverage of the American Express begins Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, on Golf Channel. And Pat McCabe is the executive director of the American Express, and Pat joins us now. Pat, you've been pretty busy since last we saw you at the American Express, not least a lot of coursework that was being done since last year's tournament. What has changed in terms of the venue for this year?
Well, hello, guys. Welcome. Thank you for having me on today, and nice to see you again. But yeah, this summer was a busy one here at PGA West. So the stadium, the Pete Dye Stadium golf course, underwent a major renovation. So they redid all 18 greens. They redid all of the bunkers as well as all of the green surrounds. And it was a three-month project with LeBar, with Tim Liddy, with the team here on site, Denver Hart, and the whole team here, Brian Sullivan. It turned out fantastic. So it was close 3 months. Their design and goal was to expand those green sizes, bring them back to the original design of Pete Dye, and I think the players are going to love it for sure.
Looking forward to seeing those changes this week. Pat, I'm curious about the impact of Nick Dunlap's win from a year ago. You had Nick Saban calling into the broadcast. He's come back to defend his title. What has been the impact of an iconic win like that?
It was a great story. I mean, look, and he had two amazing PGA Tour players in that group that he beat, right? You've got Sam Burns and Justin Thomas that he took wire to wire, that up and down that he did on the 72nd hole. I think he said he couldn't even feel his hands. He thought he had a two-shot lead, ended up being a one, had to make that six-footer on the last hole. It's been great. Nick's is such a good young man. Great to see him play well. Great to see him win again later in the summer. And I look forward to seeing him out here this week.
There is the chance of another Cinderella story this year at the American Express. Pat, Blades Brown is one of your sponsors' exemptions, just 17 years old, making his debut. If you put that in the context of the broader changes on the PGA Tour, are you sensing that there is more of a kind of a hunger for sponsor spots out there in tournaments now, simply because we've gone from 125 guys keeping their card down to 100? Yeah. So every start really means a lot to these guys.
I think that for sure. Look, I think that also seeing what Nick did last year, my phone and email was off the hook, as you might imagine. But Blades is a great story. He's making his professional debut. The other PGA Tour event that he played back in May, the Myrtle Beach Classic, he was 16 years young and made the cut. I believe he was top 25. And so, yeah, I mean, look, it's the future of the game. It's the future of this generation. He's been out here the last couple of days, Blades has. I know he played La Quinta Country Club yesterday morning. He hits it far. He's playing well. I think he's prepped and is ready, and he's mature beyond his years at just 17 years old. So excited to see what he does for the first three rounds, and hopefully makes the cut and plays well all weekend long.
Yeah, young players thriving, part of the story of the PGA Tour these days. Also, charity, a big part of what the PGA Tour does week to week. The Ophelia Project was named the PGA Tour Charity of the Year in 2024. Yeah. It supports young women and works on self-esteem. Why is that an important charity for the American Express to support?
It is. You know, it's part of the impact of the event, right? Our host organization, the Impact Through Golf Foundation, we donated over $1 million just a couple months ago alongside American Express to 16 local organizations. And the work we're doing that those groups are doing is truly tremendous. And to be recognized by the PGA Tour, 40 plus events on tour, to have them recognized, got a chance to welcome them and tell them and share that exciting news a few weeks ago, you know, and speaking with their team, 100% of the young women who go through their program graduate from high school. And that's fantastic. Over 7,000 women have gone through the program, and 100% they go on to become doctors, lawyers, and just crucial parts of the society. So thankful for the tour for recognizing. And look, $66 million in our history with this great event, and that's really what it's all about.
So much change in the game these days, Pat, not least heading into next year. There's going to be a lot of changes in terms of field sizes on the PGA Tour, but your event is one of the very few on the schedule that isn't actually changing field size at all. What kind of impact does that have on you in terms of guys who are going to be knocking on your door thinking you've got a space for them as they're trying to get enough starts to keep that card?
Yeah, we're proud that we're going to be the only 156-player field. We've got a couple reasons for that. You know, the three golf courses, of course, PGA West, the Stadium Course, the Nicklaus Course, and then La Quinta Country Club. So we've got enough daylight to accommodate. But also our Pro-Am format is such a unique part of this event. So the men and women who are participating alongside those PGA Tour players will get to continue to do that for the foreseeable future, 156 of them. And it's where they cultivate relationships. It's part of the reason why I know that the players like coming here. It's three rounds guaranteed. It's the relationships they have here in the Valley. And so it's important for us. It's important for our charities to continue to benefit to keep that field size. And we're thankful that we're in that situation.
And Pat, as you know, a number of L.A. natives have headed east to the Coachella Valley to flee the fires that are going on right now, including the World Golf Hall of Fame member Amy Alcott. How much will they be on your mind this week, even with a tournament going on so close to Los Angeles, just a couple hours to the east?
Yeah, constantly. That is something that we're paying a close eye to, paying attention to. You know, the tournament, the host organization, Impact Through Golf, made a contribution to the American Red Cross directed towards the Southern California fire relief. So many of our volunteers, players, spectators have got roots there just a few hours over the mountains. And and we're thinking of them, we're praying for them. And, you know, if we could do anything to assist, be a brief respite, be an entertainment product where people can kind of forget about hopefully those challenges and problems. And we're here to help. We're here to do anything we can. And I hope and pray that that situation gets under control as soon as possible.
We're thinking about the good folks in Los Angeles as well. Pat, we wish you a great week. Thank you so much for your time.
We appreciate it. Good to see you. Happy New Year and all the best. So I'll say hey to Larry and the team out here in the desert for you.
Please do. There he is, Pat McCabe. And Golf Today is back right after this. As Shannon sang in 1983, let the music play. Love the Ryder Cup theme song. We're counting down the days as the Ryder Cup returns to U.S. soil in September. Bethpage Black plays host as Keegan Bradley and his U.S. squad face Luke Donald and the Europeans. Well, a Ryder Cup-esque event took place over the weekend in Dubai, featuring 10 players from continental Europe competing against a 10-man squad from Great Britain and Ireland. GB and I got the 17-8 win over continental Europe under the captaincy of Justin Rose. Let's hear from a very happy and victorious captain.
Huge honor. I've loved the challenge of it, loved the experience of it, and the lads have made me look incredibly good at it. You know, the way they played was first class. I think we had one clear message, which was kind of to go out on the front foot, to try to be relentless, to play wave after wave, and you know, had a big lead coming into today. I think everyone felt that we could get the job done, obviously, but just to kind of, for everybody's own individual and personal pride, kind of continue the message of the week. And the leaderboard early in the round was just astonishing, really. And but yeah, every credit to continental Europe and Francesco himself. You saw the up and down he had on 18, and the team as a whole, you know, they fought to the very end and clawed back a few points. So the whole matches were played in such a great spirit. But yeah, my team definitely just I think hold the right putts at the right time and won most of those key matches.
The guys that played last time in this said it really helped them to get into the flavour of what it's all about.
Yeah, match play is unique. We don't do enough of it. You can't sort of just turn that tap on immediately when you need it. So having these opportunities to play that is important. There's some lessons in match play that you need to continue to remember. You can't simulate the intensity of a Ryder Cup with the crowd and the energy. But, you know, at the end of the day, as soon as you put a crest here and you have 10 mates right behind you, you want to win. You know, even in practice rounds, if we're playing with our mates on tour, you never like to lose. So the intensity is there, the competitiveness is there, just the environment's hard to kind of simulate. But like I said, I think that competitive match play is so valuable.
Just finally, we're expecting that one day you will be asked to be Ryder Cup captain. You'll certainly be hoping so. How much have you learned from this experience? What have you learned from this experience that you could potentially carry into that?
That there's a lot to think about. Yeah, there's a lot of nuance, there's a lot of detail. You need to be well prepared. I think this is obviously, I'm basically being babysat as well. You know, I've obviously tried to really give it my best in the messaging and put my stamp on my team. But to have Paul McGinley and Luke Donald as resources this week as vice captains, which are probably the two of the best Ryder Cup captains in history, and obviously Jose Maria Lathabel having him here as well. There's so much to lean on and so much to learn from that it's been a great experience for me personally, and hopefully can take that into the future, whatever that may be.
Here are those final results from Abu Dhabi, just a short drive from Dubai. Pretty striking victory. GB and I, 17 points to 8. And of course, there were some live players in the field as well, noticeably Tyrrell Hatton. Afterwards, he talked about the need to make his case for a captain's pick, most likely, for Luke Donald.
We've spoken before about the fact that it's going to be tricky for you to qualify automatically for the Ryder Cup because of the limited opportunities you get to score points. But you've made another statement to Luke Donald this week. How pleased with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think by now Luke kind of knows what I guess I'm capable of or the type of golf that I can produce. Ultimately, yeah, my job's harder to qualify for the team, but I still see it that I've got 5 events to do that. So yeah, I'm going to give it my best, and my last 3 Ryder Cups I've managed to automatically qualify, and I'd love to keep that streak going.
This probably used to mean more in the past, I think, than it does now in real terms, just because of the where most guys who are on the European team tend to make their living these days. It's a bonding exercise, perhaps a little bit more than it used to be the incubator for the Ryder Cup decision-making, because there was no Rory McIlroy in this. There was no John Rahm. There was no Ludvig Åberg. There was no Shane Lowry. There was no Victor Hovland. The guys who have been the standouts and will be the standouts and anchors of that European team weren't really there. Now, there were still a lot of quality players there, but for Luke Donald, it becomes an exercise in almost mentorship. You have a bunch of guys there who you want on the team, who you expect are going to at least be on the fringes of the team, and then try to figure out from that who can you make them comfortable with. But there are a lot of unanswered questions. I mean, he also lost Nikolai Højgaard, who you'd expect to be on that team as well, but he got ill. His twin brother Rasmus played in it. But this is talking about that almost like the lower levels of the European team, the younger kids who are going to potentially be uncomfortable in that setting. How comfortable can you make them ahead of Bethpage? And of course, you know, Tom McKibben was on that, and there's a question around Tom. Is he going to jump to live, as some reports are out there that he is not denied, pointedly not denied. So he may not even be a factor when it comes to the Ryder Cup, but still some value for Luke Donald.
Yeah, I still think it's an important bonding experience, at least if you look at social media and the pictures, David Howe and, you know, Andrew Coulthard and the likes out there enjoying themselves. Paul McGinley, you heard Justin Rose talk about the mentorship that the likes of Luke Donald and Paul were giving to Justin Rose. But also, I think it's important just when you consider how, you know, the Americans had the victory at the President's Cup. Kind of, that's their team cup. That's their ability to have Scotty and Xander and Wyndham and Colin shoulder to shoulder. Tony Finau, a lot of players will probably see at Bethpage Black in the fall.
That's not a relaxing week for those guys as well. It's the same demands. You're playing for your country, and it's a win or loss scenario for you. The Americans just don't seem to have one of these team scenarios. Maybe TGL becomes that in a weird way, but they don't have a relaxing team environment where they can just sort of test out their relationships. When the Americans are brought to a team event, they are thrown right into the cauldron.
So you think more relaxation is needed, more like a natural positions for the Americans to bond, you know, like the Europeans.
The other way, it hasn't worked out too good for you, has it?
It has. Now, we'll see what happens at Bethpage Black. The countdown is already underway. Can't wait till the end of September. We will see you on Tuesday.